Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Terechuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own website, themediabeat.us. He also is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And I do have something to kind of go on the media and attack the media here for a second, David, when we start off. Good morning.
You feel free, Marshall. You attack the media. This is the Media Beat. After all, you beat the media if you feel like it.
You would think that after 2016 and 2020, television stations would not just put the cornerstone in heavily beat on polls. They've done it. Everything you saw was polls, polls, polls. You would think that they would learn their lesson. And now I was watching MSNBC. I was watching Fox. I was watching CNN. And I noticed something. And I started watching all the other networks because CNN was the first one who put this headline up. Why pundits got midterm red wave predictions wrong. Listen. Why blame it on them? You networks live on this stuff. And when are you going to learn your lesson not to live on information that obviously now is not garnered correctly because of all the different chains in the elections? That's my...
Yeah, it's the same again, isn't it? Yogi Berra is always right, of course. It's deja vu all over again. And this time, I think there was a shading that was different and I think worse in that towards the as we went down to the wire, so many media outlets were overly swayed by a host of a fairly newly resurgent kind of polling that goes on. It began as private polling on behalf of parties themselves, and now there's a whole slew of partisan polling organizations. I'm thinking in particular of ones like Rasmussen, you know, which no real pretense to work by objective standards. It's out and out Republican or right wing conservative propagandizing. It constructs its polls on that basis. I'm not libeling them here. This is an admitted part of their business model. And they're not alone. There are others too. And they got an awful lot of attention in the media as we got towards November. Although sometimes journalists were careful to point out the partisan nature of these so-called sources they were quoting, polling companies that, you know, for instance, in Rasmussen's case, don't even adhere to the code of practice of the National Pollsters Association, and they were given far too much weight, and the whole idea of the the Republican tsunami, the red wave, was kind of configured out of thin air, or at least very little evidence. I mean, there was certainly, of course, I mean, as there always is in midterms, a swing against the incumbent administration. But you know, as we saw, and everybody is now clearly wringing their hands about it. Nothing like the big wave that was expected. Can I just break away for a moment, though?
Yes.
Marshall, I know this is going to be our main topic as we speak, but I just want to say a quick word about honor and respect. It may seem bizarre, but we are the media beat, and the medium of public art, sculpture especially, needs our attention. We have to welcome the opening today on the National Mall in Washington of the new 25 years in the making, National Native American Veterans Memorial. It's a poignant new monument honoring a people whom our country treated with shocking cruelty right from its very beginning, but who have still loyally fought for our country in the centuries since, disproportionately serving in our armed forces at a greater rate than any other community, in fact. So for that community and for all of us, really, there's a new piece of hallowed ground in the nation's capital.
And, you know, you can say that the Native American contribution in World War II was their way of hiding our messages, where we broke the German code, and the Germans never even came close to breaking our code.
And based as it was on Indian languages.
Yeah.
Yes, it's an astonishing tradition. I noticed spokesman at the Smithsonian Institution, you know, on whose ground this new monument has been erected, who himself is a member of, I think, the Pawnee Nation, saying it's an article of faith in Indian country that, yes, they play a very big part in sustaining the country's armed forces. So by contrast, let me turn and say that there's not much honor and respect in the world of political reporting during this week of the midterm elections. I think it's very telling to look at that powerhouse of Republican-supporting media, the Murdoch empire. My local rag here in the media capital of the world, New York City, is, it's not my local rag, it's Rupert Murdoch's, the New York Post. Is, of course, well known as one of the most raucous conservative voices in the country. And its front page yesterday was, as often, a blistering example of tabloidism in the way that it echoed the child's nursery rhyme, Humpty Dumpty, in a big cartoonish graphic taking up the whole page. There was a large, fat, wobbly Donald Trump sitting atop a wall with the big headline, Trumpty Dumpty. and the strap line, as certain layout experts call it, it said, Donald, who couldn't build a wall, had a great fall. Can all the GOP's men put the party together again? that's quite something from Murdoch. It's a whole world away from how the Post announced Trump's first running for the presidency back in 2015. Then the whole front page, we won't remember, was a photoshopped White House with 20 feet high, I guess 20 feet high, gold lettering saying Trump bolted to the famous front portico. And Trump himself was pictured on the lawn with a speech bubble, Donald, colon, I'll make the White House mine. So, you know, the massive support Murdoch was giving Trump then has certainly changed elsewhere in the Murdoch-owned far-right Republican mediaverse as a whole. Trump has been coming in for what he's been a well-battered target all through this week. Even Fox News, which increasingly over the past 2 years has gotten itself behind, thoroughly behind, that big Trump lie of election denying. It has now been almost gleefully attacking what they've painted as Trump's failure this week, in that the promised Republican wave, I mean, they keep calling it a red wave. The colors confuse me. I think of red as communism, but maybe that's my generational or European twist. I don't know. But that as we know, that Republican wave just didn't happen, or not as fully as was expected. I was watching Fox News, of course. I mean, you have to. one of the pundits said during the overnight coverage of results coming in, let me quote it directly, the party needs to take, the Republican Party, of course, he's talking about, but the party needs to take a really deep introspection look in the mirror right now, because this is an absolute disaster for the Republican Party, and we need to turn back. Now, that comment came from Mark Thiessen of the right-wing American Enterprise Institute. He's also one of the Washington Post's conservative columnists. So he's not a diehard Trumpist by any means. So we perhaps shouldn't be too surprised. I mean, he's of that Republican tradition, if you like. He wrote speeches for George W. Bush, for instance. But the fact that he was there on Fox saying it is indicative of Fox really very clearly staking out the battle lines within the Republican Party over whether the Trump approach is actually going to be good for them at all any longer. And let me quote, let me step back from their infighting. Let me just quote the president's reaction when he gave his traditional press conference for the day after midterms voting day. He said, it'll be fun watching them take on each other. That's the word from President Biden. He was, of course, ignoring the question he was asked, in the way that any politician learns how to ignore a question. He was being asked which Republican he'd prefer to run against in 2024 if he runs, Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis. He didn't say which, of course, but he couldn't hide his relish about both contending with each other to oppose him. And in a way, it's already fun, if you like. Well, if not fun, then certainly fascinating for media watchers like us. Another New York Post front page splash this week was to give a full page picture of Governor DeSantis celebrating his victory in Florida with his wife and a little daughter in his arms, and a big, bold headline calling him not DeSantis, but the future. There's no question about how Rupert Murdoch is seeing the country's future as he wants it.
You know, you look at all of this, and there's an old saying in broadcasting, when you work in a rated market, don't tout your success because, you know, 1 year, because ratings are taken four times a year. And the old saying is, live by the sword, die by the sword. And
yeah, absolutely.
The Republican Party, which Donald Trump took over, rolled the dice and went big time. And it looks like that the Democrats not only might have a 50-50 split in the Senate, but they might actually be 51-49. And it looks like the difference in the House is going to be in the low teens instead of 35-50. Now, the bad news about all this, David, is nothing is going to happen in Washington except the budget getting passed for 2 years. Really?
Yeah, logjam and very little movement and no chance, or very little chance of any of Biden's remaining agenda being put through. But the, you know, the attention, the spotlight will swing, of course, to what the Republicans are going to do with this thin margin of victory. Of course, I mean, it remains a victory. I mean, 51% is a win, but not to belabor the point I'm making about Murdoch, but it's telling that it will inevitably become a period of soul searching for the Republicans. And by laboring the point, I mean I can turn to the respectable press at that end of the Murdoch empire, the Wall Street Journal, which published a very clearly stated editorial yesterday. It called Trump the Republican Party's biggest loser. Not a word that Trump likes to hear applied to him. And it said, Trumpy Republicans failed at the ballot box in states that were clearly winnable. Mr. Trump now has a perfect record for electoral defeat. So, looking towards 2024, as you know, we, with our swinging spotlights, will be looking toward, who's the the Republican nomination going to be? Who's it going to go to? I think the star of Governor DeSantis is certainly on the ascendant now.
It's going to be very interesting because Donald Trump was going to announce, he probably will announce, his run for the presidency, and it will be a two-year fight amongst the governor and the former president. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the Republican Party lines up and who they line up behind, because one thing you can say about Donald Trump, the people that support him will support him no matter what. And that has the potential to be a problem for the Republican Party. His strength in numbers with people that support him is absolutely solid, rock solid.
Yeah, and that old adage that he coined himself about being able to take out a gun and shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and still have it make no impact on his political popularity will remain true, I'm sure. And whether in this two-year battle, which it obviously will be, is there any scope at all in the Republican Party for a third individual slipping in as a compromise candidate? I rather doubt it, but political journalists are scouring the lists right now and seeing who are the potential contenders of any seriousness, at least. We'll just have to see.
All right, I want to move from there to the amazing coverage that is going on in the Ukraine. The BBC actually had people out on the front lines with the Ukrainian army when we were attacking where now Russia completed its withdrawal from the only capital which they really conquered, and it's, of course, the main city in the region where they annexed. An amazing, amazing story going on here. This truly is something that will go down in the history books.
Sure. The Ukrainian army, quite sensibly, knowing that they've got locally at least this quite remarkable upper hand again, in fighting back in Kherson, population center, the main regional center, as you pointed out, of in the south, the only main center that the Russians were able to completely take over right at the beginning, after war started in February, and here the Ukrainians are retaking it, though very carefully. It's interesting to see that on the ground they're not being triumphant about it, and they're tactically being extremely careful as they move in. And the Russians, you know, formally announced from Moscow that they have retreated, a tactical retreat, of course. They're not saying that they're giving up their so-called special military operation, far from it. They appear to be doing a kind of digging in, but at the same time, their supply lines are badly interrupted. There's a very big, important river in the way that they have no way of getting their supplies across now. And thanks to the Ukrainians effectively destroying that line, and we have this remarkable case of the David and Goliath fight swinging in David's way now, and it leads to an interesting case of speculation, I guess is the word for it, but informed speculation. The forces in play and in a sense, the Pentagon is in play here. The amount of support that the Pentagon has been giving in terms of arms supplies and intelligence to the defensive arms supply in particular, and some very sophisticated missiles, of course, given to the Ukrainian side, is all part of the mix. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is interestingly pushing a certain line in the realm of speculation, which is somewhat at odds with the White House. And the kind of journalistic briefing that's going on now is very telling. General Milley is suggesting that this might be the moment, now that this remarkable military success is being registered in the Ukrainians' favor, to turn towards diplomacy. Now, that's not what the White House has been saying. It's not what President Biden himself has been saying. The official line is, we're not going to tell the Ukrainians what to do in any sense. There's no way. This is not what they're saying, but this is the underpinning thought behind the White House position at the moment, is that any hint that anything besides what Ukraine itself wants to achieve is not to be bruited. And indeed, anything to the contrary is being slapped down. But at the same time, the Joint Chiefs of Staff is suggesting something quite different. That that it's possible now, given the state of the play so far, this will be a good time for Zelensky and Putin to negotiate directly. The traditional military position is that you've got to have as much territory on the ground under your belt as you can possibly get before you can even consider negotiating with the enemy. You must be able to negotiate from a position of territorial strength. But it seems to be suggested in certain quarters, and they're very senior. General of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is not someone to blow off easily, is thinking that maybe now we're getting to the point where talking might be the best option. In Winston Churchill's old phrase, "George is better than war, war."
We'll see. There's always a certain point in a war where both sides take a look. And like you said, the Ukrainians, it's going to be how much ground they actually have taken back and hold. And for the Russians, it really is the death toll. I really think that that they really now are just at the point where they just don't. I mean, the estimates that have come in now are 200,000 dead, 100,000 on each side. And that's just military people. It's frightening when you look at it. And I think that those two things, you're right, the amount of land that the Ukrainians have taken back and the amount of deaths, I think, will tend to lead to talks. I don't know how successful they'll be, but will tend to lead to talks.
You mentioned the BBC coverage. There was one still photographic image that the BBC presented us with this week, which was, I think, very pointed. It was a large group of new recruits, in the Russian army, drafted people, of course, wearing those big fur hats that Russian soldiery wear, especially in winter, being blessed by a Russian Orthodox priest, scattering holy water over them. I think that seemed to be what the image was. But the telling thing of inevitably was the formality of that, the religiosity of it. It's something that Putin is very insistent upon for his concept of his Russia. But along with it, the shockingly youthful faces of these young boys who are being sent off many of them to their deaths, of course. And though I don't suppose many Russians would see that picture, although, of course, in these days of social media, even with the clampdown that the Kremlin has imposed, people will start to see, will have already started to see such pictures, and maybe even more that we don't know about. And there's certainly a sense that there are limits to how much the dictatorial powers of Putin can keep the lid on this and allow him to continue to squander his own nation's blood and treasure the way that he's doing. But again, you know, I know it's a journalistic gymnastic flip almost, but we will just have to see. But it doesn't look it doesn't look good for Putin and the Kremlin right now.
Well, you are about to undertake I think it's an annual tour. You're not going to be broadcasting from New York. You're heading overseas once again. And what a great time for you to be heading overseas with all that's what's going on over there. I mean,
good time to leave America. You mean?
Yeah, because you got just as much turmoil over there that you can now report.
Oh yeah, there's no shortage of turmoil for me to report on. I'm going to Europe. And I will be reporting in not from the media capital of the world next Friday, but from Dublin on the western fringe of Europe, but still in Europe, unlike that other island next door to it, which is now creating its own form of chaos. Britain, I'm talking about my old homeland. They're not European anymore, and they're having to live with the results of that decision.
Well, it should be. So how long will you be gone on this?
I'll be reporting back into the media capital of the world, New York City, in January. So I'll be away a good 8 weeks or so.
Well, it's going to be great because you're going to get once again you get that look at America and you get a look at the international news in a total different look when you're going to be in Europe.
Yeah, journalism always requires a shift in perspective, it seems. Even when you're in the middle of things, you've got to try and step out of them. And it's certainly good for the journalistic mentality to have a fresh standpoint every now and again. It's an article of faith for me to always take into account what things look like from the outside.
Well,
so I'm going to be in Europe.
Have a safe trip, and we'll speak to you next week from Europe on the Media Beat.
Absolutely. Look forward to that.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on The Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio.